Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. This week, we will be talking about downtown in the Skid Row community with Russell Brown, manager of the Downtown LA Exchange, and Arietta Browers and Kevin Michael King of the Los Angeles Poverty Theater. Also sitting in with us would be our stage manager, Mr. Lee Shaw. But first, I would like to announce a historical occasion in the California prison system, a truce to end all hostility among the races inside the California prison system, including the county jails and the youth authorities. I'd like to read from that, starting off with, on October the 10th, 2012, all hostility between our racial groups in SHU, ADSEG, general population, and county jails will officially cease. This means that from this date on, all racial group hostility need to be at an end. And if personal issues arise between individuals, people need to do all they can to exhaust all diplomatic means to settle such dispute. Do not allow personal individual issues to escalate into racial group issues. Also, as far as the young people is concerned, as young people who have experienced bloodshed on the streets of Los Angeles and the violence and humiliation within juvenile halls, probation camps, and divisions of juvenile justice youth prison, we are also calling for an end to the war between the youth. We are challenging all youth in the streets, schools, and lockups throughout California to do the following. End all the killing and drama between the hoods, the crews, races. Declare a temporary ceasefire and work towards building a lasting truce. Take the same mentality and skills we have used to hustle drugs, bang our hoods, and promote our crews to unite in a powerful movement to demand dignity, respect, and equality for all people. Spread the word to unite all hoods, all barrios, all crews, all cliques, all cells, all dorms, and all units, from Nickerson Garden, from the PJs to the YJs, from the TJs to Pelican Bay to the Bay Area, and back down to Sactown. Let everyone know, as youth of California, we are not down with the lockdown. And I'm going to ask a person who's a member of Critical Resistance to comment on that, Kevin Michael Key.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Melvin. It is a wonderful thing that the men and the women who are locked up in these horrible cages are now beginning to understand that disunity breeds disrespect and a loss of power. It's bad enough that the state has locked up more than 100,000 men and women from the communities that can least afford to not have men in those communities. And then when they get into these prison cages where they're treated like animals by the state, that they revert to that state. And so this is a historic agreement. I hope that it is adhered to because these men who are in the SHU unit have been engaged in a historic hunger strike for quite some time. And they have come to realize that struggling against each other only hurts their cause. So it is historic that these brothers of all nationalities are coming together and recognizing that the commonness of their situation, and they're going to stand together so that we can begin to dismantle piece by piece this terrible thing we call the prison industrial complex, where a state like California that has the 8th largest economy in the world is number 50 among the 50 states in K through 12 spending and is number one in prison construction spending. Mm-hmm. So I hope that the people in the street that hear this announcement will join together, and that we will stand together and not allow Sheriff Baca and the Board of Supervisors to expand the county jail system, what is already in Los Angeles County, which is already the world's largest county jail system, and that we can begin to find ways to create a new vision of how we deal with the harms that we inflict upon each other. So this is a historic event, and thank you for announcing that.
Okay. Thank you, Kevin Michael Key. This week we will be talking about the downtown Skid Row community, and I'm delighted to have with us in the studio Russell Brown, the manager of the downtown L.A. Exchange located at 114 West 5th Street. Russell, welcome to the Coonram Report.
Thank you. Welcome, and thanks for the invitation to be here tonight.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little about yourself, and how did you begin working in the downtown area?
Sure. I moved downtown about 10 years ago, and at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of people living down here. There were a few people in Bunker Hill. There were a lot of affordable housing in Skid Row area, but there really wasn't a residential community. It was the 9-to-5 typical sort of business community that you hear about. And I had been living in Hollywood Hills for 10 years and always had the idea of living in old buildings or living in a loft. So the only place to do that was downtown. So I sold my house in the Hollywood Hills that I'd spent 10 years redoing and moved downtown and realized fairly quickly when I did that, almost everybody thought I was sort of crazy. It was like, you live where? Nobody lives down there. You know, literally I'd get calls like, is it safe to be there? Where do I park my car? But more importantly, what in the world are you doing? And we had gotten used to being sort of a pioneer. I remember when I first moved downtown, Midnight Mission was at 4th in Los Angeles. So you could I'd look out my loft and I'd see 1,000 people, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all right there where it's now Toy District. Pete's Cafe had just opened. There was literally nothing on the street. I could look all the way down from 4th and Main down to the Huntington Hotel, and it looked like lightning bugs all up and down the street. And if you're not from the South, you don't really know what lightning bugs or fireflies are. But there were so many people smoking crack on the street, it literally looked like lightning bugs all up and down the street. I remember years ago when Blossom Cafe opened. It's a great Vietnamese restaurant on Main Street at Winston. People thought, nobody will ever walk to the other side of the street to even go to that building. And so downtown has had some amazing, amazing changes, and I've been excited to be part of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the downtown LA Exchange?
When I first moved downtown, I started an organization called SELA, and S-E-L-A-H, and that was my community organizing background of basically helping the community create a common space, sort of a community center. That was in the Arts District. And when we did that 10 years ago, it had a great run for a couple of years, but I think it was ahead of the curve because the Arts District had not really created sort of a residential neighborhood and a community. About 4 years ago, the opportunity came up for the ground floor space in the Roslyn Hotel that had been an art gallery before. And my jobs at the time were executive director of the Historic Downtown Bid, which works with Chrysalis to do the cleaning programs for the sidewalk and works with private security that we hire. It's the people that you see in the purple shirts or the green mm-hmm. shirts riding around on bicycles and on Segways now, helping sort of maintain order. And we also do a lot of economic development. So I took that job, and I also was volunteer director and president of Neighborhood Council for 5 years to bring both the business and the community folks together and work with folks like you through Skid Row community programs, the Neighborhood Council's planning departments, our affordable housing department, and a lot of artists to create a community space.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, also, how would you like to see the exchange fit into the overall downtown culture life now?
I was looking back at the calendar that we had over the last 3.5 years. We had more than 400 events there. Mm-hmm. It's been everything from art galleries to plays to music to theater. Almost every, the Neighborhood Council's planning committee meets there. So every single bar, restaurant, skyscraper project comes through, and we spend 3 or 4 hours once a month discussing planning issues, but more importantly, discussing the issues of community. What do businesses and restaurants and bars need to do to be safe, to be good neighbors, to create jobs for local folks? We've had plays and theaters and art events there. The Downtown Comedy Club was hosted there for more than 3.5 years with a great run. They've now decided to move to another space. And so we're looking for new partners to create another series of events. I think as the neighborhood's changed in 10 years, it's time for the activities to change also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, can you tell us, what is D-Link?
Downtown LA Neighborhood Council, is a system of neighborhood councils. If you remember, about 12, 15 years ago, the city of LA looked like it was sort of falling apart. San Pedro, Hollywood, the Valley wanted to secede from the whole city. And if you take Hollywood and the Valley and San Pedro out, more than half the city would have been gone. A lot of people felt at the time that the city was too big and was not manageable. So it was a way of changing the system of government of the city to basically create neighborhood councils, and there's now more than 90 neighborhood councils in every district, to be sort of the local voice of people. D-Link pretty much includes everything within the circle of the freeway. We also go a little bit across the freeway to City West, and we also go below the freeway to Washington. But it's all the businesses, it's the residents. We have a homeless slot. We have 3 slots for arts, educational, and culture. We have social services. We have labor unions. So it really brings everybody together. There's 28 boards. Board members, and elections are actually coming up November 15th.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you were the president of D-Link for a number of years. What are some of the things you think that can improve D-Link and make it a better organization?
D-Link's been around about 10 and a half years. 5 of those years I was president. I'm still very involved, even though I'm not a board member, and that was one of the great things about D-Link. We made a space for people to get involved, whether you're on the board or whether you're outside the board. I think we've been at the forefront of working with Metro on the regional connector, on the streetcar, complete streets and bicycle lanes. We've also tried to work closely with LAPD and especially the Skid Row providers and the residents in Skid Row to sort of listen to them and mediate when there's disagreements with the city, and also try to give people who don't necessarily have a voice a way to bring their projects forward.
Okay. And can you tell us a little about what is Arts Walk and how did Arts Walk, how did it get started?
Actually, Art Walk was one of the first projects that the Neighborhood Council did. When all the folks were moving downtown, especially in historic downtown, there was a lot of abandoned buildings. The lofts started opening, and they had never been able to rent out the retail spaces on the ground floor because the neighborhood was not really in great shape. So all these people started moving in upstairs, and a lot of them were artists. And they went to the landlord and said, look, you'll take our money for rent. We'd like to have art studios and some retail shops downstairs. Why don't you let us rent those spaces fairly inexpensively? They've sat there empty for 10, 15, 20 years. So a number of the galleries started opening. And there were 3 or 4 or 5 of the galleries who were the original pioneers. Pharmaco was one of them. Martha Higgins had a gallery. Burt Green was one of the early art galleries. And so they were doing their opening events on different nights. So they decided, why don't we all just do our similar events on the same night? and that way we'll invite people to come. And so they created the second Thursday of the night of Art Walk. Shane Gufog, who was the founder of Pharmaca, used to laugh that the very first Art Walk, he had 12 people in his gallery. 8 of them were his friends, and all 8 of those people said, "See, I told you, you're crazy. Nobody will ever come downtown." We now have almost 30,000 people who come downtown for Art Walk. And if you haven't come, it's the second Thursday of the month. But more importantly, I think when you come down, you realize downtown's for everybody. There's a place that you can wander around, explore old buildings, see all different kinds of interesting events. But more importantly, if you want to get involved, you can create your own space, your own art walk, your own music.
Okay. Can you just talk a little about the art walk and the conflict with the Occupy group? What was that about?
Actually, what Occupy did, and I'm a very progressive liberal, and I think it's sort of interesting sometimes when people try to put the Occupy LA and the Art Walk on two different sides of the coin, because in many ways the Art Walk is the most grassroots populist event in almost the whole city. I think Occupy started out with a great message of, you know, let's work towards creating jobs, let's work towards changing a system that seems to be rigged for the corporations. Let's really talk about grassroots employment, be anti-war, be able to get out that message. When they were forced to leave City Hall, they moved over to Pershing Square. And I think at Pershing Square, they really didn't have a message of what the next steps were. A small group of the Occupy folks decided to create a forum, which was basically 30 or 40 people in the middle of one of the art walks. And of course, they did it, I think, purposely because that's where the crowds were. But when you take 30 or 40 people, mix it with a lot of bars and liquor on the corner of 5th and Spring, and purposely have a lot of people fighting with the LAPD, it involved a whole crowd. And I think in retrospect, it could have been handled a lot differently. Mm-hmm. If the purpose of Occupy LA was to get visibility, I think they did that, but they also did it in a way that I don't think was conducive to helping their cause. You've now seen Occupy LA sort of fall apart or disappear. I still think there's very, very much of a need for their original message to be part of the dialogue, and I hope somehow that can come out in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Russell. We'll be coming back to you when we get to our roundtable section.
Great.
Now we're going to take a little short break for our community calendar with Ms. Earlene Anthony.
This is the community calendar for the month of October. Every Tuesday from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., Drama Stage Coon Run has the Veterans Community Theater Workshop. This workshop is open to veterans and non-veterans. The location is the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard, and that's near the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic. And the Metro bus number 60 and 66 stops right at or near the corner. If you're interested in the workshop, the contact information is 323-850-4436. Call in all Skid Row artists. This is a 2-day event, and it's the 3rd annual festival for all Skid Row artists. This will be Saturday and Sunday, October 20th and the 21st, from 12 noon to 4 p.m. The location is Gladys Park, and this is a LAPD event. It's also a free event organized by LAPD, USEP, LAP Committee, and the Fine Arts Program. They're looking for spoken word artists, rappers, singers, poets, theatrical performances, music of all kinds. And if you're interested in contacting them or being on their show, the LAPD number is 213-413-1077. And once again, that's the LA Poverty Department. And that's Saturday and Sunday, October 20th and 21st from 12 noon to 4 p.m. Sunday, October the 28th at 3 p.m., Drama Stage Coon Run presents the Nasana Play Reading Series. we will present a stage play written by Yvette Hay Liger and directed by Yvonne Farrell, entitled White House Wives, Operation Lysistra. Upcoming guests on the Cool Run Report, Monday, October the 22nd, will be Yvonne Farrell. She is the twin sister of Yvette Hay Liger, the one we will be reading the play on the Nisana Play Reading Series. This is just a reminder, if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Early and Anthony. The call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Miss Earlene Anthony. Now we're back with our other in-studio guests, Arietta Bowers and Kevin Michael Key of the Los Angeles Poverty Department. Welcome to the Qumran Report.
Hi, Melvin.
Thanks, Mel.
Yeah.
Now, before, and Earl.
Yeah,
right.
And Earl.
Before we get into in-depth discussion about the history of the company, I would like to read something about a historic community theater company that reminds me of the L.A. Poverty Department. By 1922, under Jiggs Cook's leadership, the Provincetown Players could boast of having produced 93 new American plays by 47 playwrights. After their presentation of Eugene O'Neill's expressionistic play, The Emperor Jones, featuring the critically praised African-American actor Charles Giffen, James Weldon Johnson claimed that the Provincetown Players was the initial and greatest force in opening up the way for the blacks on that dramatic stage, for the African-American on the dramatic stage. A remarkable feature of the group was the unusually large quantity and quality of participation of women, both in artistic and managing function. In their 6 short years in New York, they had presented the first truly experimental American plays, futuristic, surrealistic plays, plays with often potent political themes, poetic and very verse plays, plays that showed the plight of lower and middle-class Americans and immigrants. And the group had launched the career of Eugene O'Neill, Susan Glasspell, both of whom would win numerous awards, including the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. Glasspell presented softer yet powerful complex women's as lead character and without thumping pulpit approach. She becomes important as a feminist playwright, bridging the Victoria era with the modern. In short, the Provincetown Players launched American playwriting into the modern era and made a pathway for serious American playwrights to begin writing artistic plays about serious issues. So, and that's what the Provincetown Players, I mean, that's what LAPD, Los Angeles Poverty Department, remind me of when I think about J.S. Cooks and Susan Glasspell. I think about you and John. But let's get off into the first thing that I want to ask you. Can you tell us a little about yourself and how you got into theater? Let's start with Arietta, and then we'll go to Kevin Mike.
Okay. Well, I was I'm born in the Netherlands, so I'm Dutch. And I started dancing, really. That's how I got into theater. I started studying classical dance and then modern dance, and then I went to theater school, and then I decided I wanted to make plays but still use a lot of movement in it. And then I went to Paris and I studied corporeal mime. So if you want to know how it all started, you know, it's a long story.
Yeah.
And then I came back to the Netherlands and I started making my own performances and also singing. I sang in a salsa band, a Dutch salsa band, if you believe me. And actually, that's how I learned my first Spanish. And and so I started making my own performances, directing, performing, a lot of movement, a combination of movement and theater and and singing. And then, well, to make a very long story short, I ran into John Malpiet, who was who was in the Netherlands. He was working at a school for advanced for people who have finished their official art education and are going to do a sort of follow-up education, sort of specialized school for visual artists, performance artists, different kinds of artists. And he was teaching a course there with, I think it was with Ping Chong at the time. And but he had been teaching there all along. But it was my American friend, because at that time I actually was performing in America myself. So John and I sort of crossed the ocean at the same time in 1992. He came to the Netherlands with Los Angeles Poverty Department. They performed in Amsterdam at the Mickery Theater. And in 1993, I performed at the Baltimore Theater Project with a performance that I had made. Mm. And I met an actress there, Joy Ehrlich, and she came to the Netherlands to study dance and met John and asked him to direct her in a solo performance, The Fever she was doing, which was a very political play. And so that's how I met John, when she asked me to come and see the dress rehearsal of that performance.
Okay.
And and then the long story short,
the rest is history.
Yeah.
Oh, John.
All right, Kevin, how did you get off the acting, and how did you come in contact with the LA Poverty Department?
Totally through the other LAPD, the Los Angeles Poverty Department. As you know, Mel, I'm a 12-stepper. And we were opening up the James Wood Community Center at 5th and San Pedro. And so I was part of the group that started this Cocaine Anonymous meeting. And somebody in their wisdom had scheduled both our meeting and a L.A. Poverty Department rehearsal that Henriette was directing in the same space at the same time. And rather than us being at loggerheads, we found a way to coexist, depending on the needs of each of our groups. Sometimes we had a small meeting, so we'd go upstairs. Otherwise, Henriette and them would. So I had been seeing these advertisements around the community. LAPD wants you. I wondered what I did this time. And then when I found out the LAPD stood for the LA Poverty Department, I began looking into it. And I've got to say, it was a sad bunch of rehearsals they was doing. Turned out the performance was beautiful, actually. And so Henriette and I got to be friends, and she kept telling me, you got to meet John. John is the coolest guy. And then it turns out that John is a pretty cool guy. And when I went to see their performance, because I figured somebody in the audience is going to have to clap for my friends, the performance was inspiring. And it was people that I knew from the community. And so I decided that I would be an audience member for life. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I got a legal background. I've been trained as a lawyer. And their next piece was called Agents and Assets, which involved community people sitting in the role of congressmen and asking pointed questions and pointing their fingers. And shoot, I could do that. So I got the acting bug. And then I found out that as an artist, I could still be an advocate for the people of my community. Mm-hmm. And so we began working together, and our friendship grew. And I introduced you to LAPD and Ron Allen. And, you know, so it's been a really good place where my passion and my activism has been allowed to flower. And LAPD is a wonderful, wonderful group and a community asset.
Let me ask this then. What should be the goal of a... Because the LAPD work with a lot of homeless in the recovery zone. What should be the goal of a homeless theater company?
Well, maybe I should say a little bit about how LAPD started, mm-hmm. because I didn't start LAPD. LAPD was started by John Malpied
mm-hmm.
28 years ago. And that was really in the time when there was nothing, nothing on Skid Row, certainly not a theater group. The only people that were there was actually the Catholic Worker. And Nancy Minty, who started the legal clinic right behind the Catholic Worker. And John was a performance artist in New York, and that was in the 80s. That was like 84. And that's actually when people started talking about homelessness. Before that, the whole concept of homelessness didn't even exist. You know, we had some bums or something, but homeless people, they were not there. So he was interested in it, and he made a performance about homelessness in New York. And then, of course, we had the Olympic Games coming to Los Angeles, and the homeless people that were showing up had to disappear, and he got really interested in that and started working on Skid Row. They invited him to come do a project here, but what he really did was he became one of the paralegals for the legal clinic.
Inner city law.
And he started hanging out at the DPSS office and listening to people's stories and getting evidence for the class action lawsuits that you were still able to file then. Now can't even do that. It's case by case. And so he became a voice for many people, and many people told them his story and started hanging out at the offices there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Nancy Minty said, but you're an artist, aren't you? And John was like, well, you know, artist. Well. She said, why don't you start a workshop here? And so that's what they did. When the lawyers went home, they pushed back the chairs and the tables and the desks, and they started improvising, and that's really how LAPD started.
Mm-hmm.
And it started with the stories of the people, and they made their own stories. LAPD rarely, I think maybe never, has done a play that has already been written. LAPD always makes up their own plays from the stories, from the people, and the issues that... And I think if you ask me, you know, what should a homeless theater group do? There's many different ways homeless theater groups can exist and take on what they think is it, what LAPD does is and always has done is to tell the stories of the people that can't tell their own story, mm-hmm. and connect, but also make it bigger than the personal issues. What LAPD does, it connects these personal experiences with the social experiences that shape the lives of the people and that influence them. So we try to make those connections.
Yeah, okay. I heard John say one time, we tell the rest of the story. And I think that that's very important, because there are different narratives depending on where you sit. Mm-hmm. So very often we'll hear the politicians and the policymakers talking about Skid Row in the crudest way, as a blighted community. As a person who lives, works, and got clean and sober in Skid Row, and as a member of LAPD, I went around the world representing Skid Row as the biggest recovery community anywhere. Because, of course, I feel like any place that could save my wretched self, you know, has to be the biggest. But when I look around, Mel, you see all types of recovery every day, everywhere.
That's what I want to ask you about. Well, also, I want to say, hey, I would love for Survivor, I would love for L.A. Poverty Theater to do
Surviving the Nickel.
One of our.
Oh, yeah.
But how does homeless theater fit into the concept of recovery?
Well, let me say one thing, Mel. Mm-hmm. One thing, your question, which we did the political thing and didn't answer, what should a homeless theater troupe
what should it look like?
Goal? I think, number one, L.A. Poverty Department was the first theater troupe that was made up primarily of homeless people. And at the time, there wasn't much housing for the homeless community.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first goal is to help get people housing if that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And very often, you know, people come to us, they began to feel empowered because there's something special about all of a sudden your worth's and your thoughts coming to life in a performance piece, hopefully you get stabilized enough where you want to take that next step. But we meet people where they are. Everybody, LAPD is open to. And then from there, if you get stable and you want to find, we will try and help you find housing.
So that's part of the recovery concept. Go ahead, Irene. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, really what LAPD does and has been the goal from the very beginning of LAPD is create community.
Yeah.
And that is really what LAPD has done for 28 years. It has helped build the community that there is right now on Skid Row. You know, and I think that that is very important. LAPD has always told the story of what is really going on. You know, we have always, and we are still working on showing the real face of the community and acknowledging that there is a community. Because in a lot of talk about Skid Row, it's never acknowledged as a community. It's a bunch of homeless people or criminals or drug addicts, and it isn't. There's a real community on Skid Row, and we helped build it. And, you know, many people have helped build it. You know, the last big performance that we did was Walk the Talk, was about 36 people in the community, like Jeff Dietrich and Catherine Morris and Nancy Minty and Pete White and Molly Lowry, who cited Lamp. You know, it's
and
many,
Officer
many
Rich.
Officer Rich, you know, at the DPSS office, who helped so many people stay on SSI and get their, you know, benefits and all of that. All these people and many more. And new people come to it every day, really.
Well, let me
ask community.
You this. Can you talk a little about the process? I think it's very interesting, the process and how LAPD creates their production.
So what we do a lot of, the beginning is what I just told you. It's just people telling stories and starting with those stories and then, you know, make good theater out of it. And not put it together in a simple way, but really try to get to the bottom of it and find new forms to tell this story so that it's shared, not, you know, with a broad community. And but we do a lot of research. The more and more, you know, like do this, these 36 portraits that we did, they ended up in 3 days of parades. We paraded all over Skid Row for 3 days every afternoon. And they ended up being 10-minute scenes about each person. But we spent 1.5 years working on this particular project. So part of it was a visual arts project. Mr. Brain was, I took pictures of many people or asked them from their pictures from long ago. And then we had a visual artist, Mr. Brain was, who designed portraits from these people. We interviewed all the people that are still alive, if they were moved out, like another person was, for example, the first director of SRO, Andy Robeson, who lives now in Portland. Then we did a Skype interview. But all the people that were here or that we could trace back, we did 1 hour, 2 hour interviews. And it's not that we did the interviews, LAPD did the interviews. We invited the whole community to come and listen to these people and ask them the questions. So, you know, and over a period of time, that's why we take now more than a year or sometimes, you know, longer to build a project, because the project has different stages. We work with all the different people that work in the communities, organizations, service providers. We do short projects that lead up to the big one. So there's a long process.
Well, speaking of the projects, let's deal with one more subject, and then we open it up to the round table. Can you tell us about the event this weekend?
That's very important. So, yeah, it's the third year that we're doing the festival for all Skid Row artists. And also this festival, which is a lot of fun, because we did it the first time 1 day, and 1 day was not enough, because there are many, many artists on Skid Row. And so we had to do it 2 days, and even 2 days we still had to send people away. But it also comes out of a process of a big community engagement. 3 years ago, the Urban Institute asked Los Angeles Poverty Department to do a research in the area about creativity in the area. And so John Malpied and Maria Rosario Jackson
wrote a white
started
paper.
A long process. Yeah. So we had a community convenings for. Of 20, you know, people in the community, and then a community convening of service providers and organizations. And we asked them the questions about where does creativity happen, how does it manifest itself, how do people nurture it, how do they do it, how et cetera. Mm. And out of that, they wrote this long report
about the course
about, you know, that says... oh, God, now the title escapes me.
Mm-hmm. But it dealt with the cause of life.
The case.
Making the case for Skid Row culture.
Yeah. Right.
And in from out, and it basically states that in Skid Row, culture comes from the ground up. It's not initiated by institutions. It's the people themselves.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And they do it wherever they can. They do it on the street. They do it in the park. They do it in institutions. Wherever they feel safe and they have a space to do it. And we wanted to nurture this idea and give people a platform and a space where they are safe and they can be heard. We film all the performances. We document all the visual art. You know, we bring it out.
Can you make a tabloid paper?
Can you tell us the basic information about the dates and the time, location of the event this coming weekend?
So it's in Gladys Park.
Which is located on 6th Street between Sanford and Gladys.
And it starts at 12 o'clock at noon.
On Saturday, October 20th.
And on Sunday, October the 21st.
Same time, from 12 to 4. And you will be amazed if you come out. And one of the thing is that there is a plethora of talented and creative people.
How about?
Some of them have formal training.
Yeah.
Some of them are just naturally talented. And then because of LAPD and John and Henriette's reputation, we had Robert Gupta. Mm-hmm. We had people, you know, from he plays for the Philharmonic, and other talented people who heard about this and wanted to see what was going on in this community and shared with us as we shared with them. It was a beautiful thing.
That's a few people that we invited from outside Skid Row.
Mainly Skid Row people.
And because he does the Skid Row Orchestra.
I would be there. I'm coming to do my little 10 minutes.
But I also want
to know about food, you're going to have plenty of food and drinks,
No. Wait a minute.
No, you know
what happens when you bring out the food.
You cannot serve food in the park. No.
We will have water.
We'll have water. And the waterman is coming, so there will be.
Because I remember some chicken that John had at the first event, and then...
And you remember what happened?
Yeah, they overran. Okay, look, let's open up the discussion to a roundtable discussion. And I'd like to bring back Russell Brown to join in, and also Lee Shaw.
Russ Brown and the Band of Renown. You coming out, Russ?
The first thing that I want to do is let's talk about what are your thoughts about people getting out of prison and getting trapped on the in the Skid Row area. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, I'm going to jump right in there.
Yeah.
I seem to know a little something about that. You know, Strain is a criminal defense lawyer. As a result of my addiction, I have experienced incarceration. I'm a member of Critical Resistance. I work in USEP. So this is something that's near and dear to me. And Skid Row has a space for everybody. And what all of those organizations I'm talking about is trying to do is help people get a leg up and get a leg out, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Of the mess, the muck and the mire that they found themselves in. And this is one of the few places where they can, if given the opportunity and they take advantage of that opportunity, begin the slow process of rebuilding their lives. We're going to be showing a film on Wednesday called Finding Normal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the first things you hope to do when you get out of the clutches of the prison industrial complex. Very often, you know, some of the terms and conditions of parole or probation are fine, gainful employment. But every time you fill out a job application, there's a little box that says, have you ever been convicted of a felony?
Okay.
If you do that box, you're caught. So, and it also involves housing. It also involves educational and food and other, certain other benefits. So, Skid Row opens their arms to folks like that. And so we want to find a way to work that in.
Okay. Russell, Lee, what are your thoughts on people coming about, especially with the realignment things? Did they change the whole equation down there? And then Lee?
I think the realignment just shows the failed prison system we have. We have more people in California prison than most countries have. You look at a lot of people that get caught in the system, and it starts when they're very, very young. You know, there's no education opportunities. There's no after-school programs. They're coming from families that aren't in a stable environment with resources there and a father and a mother who are there to be role models. And then it starts from the very beginning. And if you also just look at the racial statistics, you see that when someone is arrested for crack, as opposed to cocaine, which is primarily a black versus white issue, you know, the sentence is 10 times greater for crack than the same amount of cocaine. You know, it seems insane that you can steal tens of millions of dollars from a bank and you can sort of get off with 2 years probation. But if you have $100
worth of crack in your department, in your pocket, then you have a real problem.
Mm-hmm. Lee?
No. Maxine Waters talked for about 3 hours in Congress about the crack system or the cocaine system, right? Why a man could get 500 pounds of cocaine and get 10 years, and a man has 5 ounces of crack cocaine and get 20 years, right? So her talking did some justice. There's a book by D'Amico Booth this is what woke me up to it, right? On how people set apart things, right? And I'm going to mention some names here in a minute. One of them is our mayor, Villaraigosa. The next one I'm going to mention is Sheriff Ibaka. And the next one I'm going to mention is a religious man. His name was Mahoney, Cardinal Mahoney, right? Mm-hmm. 2001, January 1st, Times said that they had come into a system, they wanted to pardon a cocaine dealer, right? Now, if I'm lying, all you got to do is go back to the Times, January 1st, find out. These people asked Bill Clinton to pardon a cocaine dealer. And you leave these poor crack dealers locked behind bars, right? Mm-hmm. I say, you're foolish. For thinking that I'm foolish, you know what I'm saying? No.
Well, let me ask this: then, what are your thoughts about the many military veterans that find themselves in the Skid Row area?
They ain't got no.
Okay.
If anybody tells them what they gonna face coming out, they probably wouldn't go in. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he go a man, they go fight for his country, and then when he leaves, after fighting for his country, he comes out, right, worse than he went in.
Well, mm-hmm. Mel, when I classify Skid Row as the world's largest recovery community, my issue is drugs and alcohol. Well, we're talking all types of recovery. So we're talking disabled military vets. We're talking about women who are escaping from domestic violence situations. We're talking about men and women who are trying to escape from the clutches and the stigmatization of the prison industrial complex.
How did they get there?
We're talking about people who have mental health issues. Skid Row openly receives and seeks to take care of all of these people, the elderly. Mm-hmm. And so what this community has been, in one sense, it's been a dumping ground, but in another sense, it's been a proving ground, because if you really have the wherewithal and the desire, and you catch a couple of good breaks, understand me, because you need a few breaks where the police don't catch you when you got a jaywalking warrant, and right. you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's what mm-hmm. Skid Row has availed to me,
yeah.
and hundreds and thousands yeah. of other people, which is why I've dedicated the rest of my career.
Mail.
Let me get off into this.
Let me ask a question.
So some winding down. Go ahead.
I've seen this thing with myself, and I walk through Skid Row quite often, right? And I've seen people on Skid Row that I talked to that was perfectly sane one day, and 5 months later, as cuckoo as a butt. Cuckoo. You know what I'm saying? Talking to themselves. I mean, going all through the... So what's happening with Skid Row?
Mm-hmm.
What is really happening with Skid Row? Is Skid Row helping Skid Row, or is Skid Row trying to push itself up the first Skid Row and leaving the rest of them down at the bottom?
Okay. No,
one of the things people don't understand, I think, about Skid Row is there's 15,000 people who live and work in Skid Row that are not on the streets. These are folks who have businesses there. There are folks who are in affordable housing units. And even when they're working as much as they can to sort of take care of their own priorities and their own lives, literally they have to walk out on the street, and all the temptations that they just got away from are there every single day. Imagine doing AA meetings at the happy hour bar where you have an open tab all the time. Mm-hmm. That's sort of what the community is. I remember when I first started with D-Link, and I knew very little about Skid Row, and there was a group called Project Homeless Connect that they do once a year mm-hmm. to really bring in all the social service providers, bring in the doctors, the dentists, the people who can give you IDs, the people that can register you for benefits. And the neighborhood council was going to be part of it, of the street festival. And we had a couple of women in the group, and myself and them were scared to death to sort of walk in the community because somehow we thought we were just going to be, you know, at risk. We did something as simple as Leslie Taupin at the time organized a book drive, and she collected thousands and thousands of books. And we did just a pop-up tent. And we had a number of our own board members said, you shouldn't do this. It's going to be a waste. People are going to take the books and they're going to sell them for drugs. And it's going to be a total, you know, waste of time. We put a limit of 2 books per person. So we wanted to make sure that we had enough books for everybody. And we were amazed that in 8 hours, we had hundreds of people who stood there for an hour or 2 hours looking through all the books because they knew they could only get a couple of books. And they asked for travel books because they said, my life, I have so little going on that I need to escape. Mm-hmm. I need dictionaries because there's words in applications for jobs I don't understand. I need basic math books and things that I can better myself. And we started realizing then that those folks were us, but they had a couple of breaks that went the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And it built a bond between us that I think from then on we started realizing there was no us versus them. It was all of us we needed to work together.
Okay, thank you. What I need to do now, I need to give everybody about maybe about 25 or 30 seconds of a quick closing comments because we're winding down. Let's start about 25 or 30 seconds. Start with Lee to roll it around.
One of the questions I wanted to ask our guest here, you'll see this right here. And I want to really know your opinion about this. I mean, not right now, but your opinion, period, about this right here. Okay. This. How do you see it?
Okay. We'll go. It'll
be passed around.
Okay.
You're referring to our article in the LA Times about the mayor wanting to do sort of a library debit card for illegal immigrants.
Actually, a legal ID card. For mm-hmm. those who, we have federal immigration law.
Yeah.
But he wants to change this law and make his own law.
Okay. Okay, we probably just a few comments, a few closing comments. We only got about maybe about 30 seconds apiece.
Yeah, I've learned being here for downtown in 10 years, and there's everything from affordable housing units to million-dollar condos. You can say a lot about downtown, but it's never boring. Everywhere you walk, literally every single day is a new adventure. And I find it so amazing to be able to meet folks from every background in the world
with the arts groups to the sports events to, you know, just having a free movie in Pershing Square or watching the kids at Grand Avenue Park for free run around. It just, I think there's no better neighborhood in the city that you can understand all the complexities and the opportunities of a city.
Okay, about 20 seconds.
Oh, gosh. Well, I totally agree. I must say, for me, Skid Row is the only neighborhood where I know most of the people on the street when I walk and they say hi, and that doesn't happen very often to me in LA. I love it. And I say, please come all out and let us know if you are a performer, because we want you to perform and bring your visual art as well to the festival.
Okay.
As a native New Yorker, to me, Skid Row is the New York part of LA. I love it here, and I wouldn't be in any other part of the city.
Thank you. Earlene.
I want to know if we come to the Skid Row Festival, are we going to get a pair of those really cool shades?
That's true.
Like
and cool sunglasses. That's
okay. Yeah. All right. Now, I would like to extend a special thanks to Russell Brown, Arietta Bowers, Kevin Michael Key, Lee Shaw, and my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Please check out past shows of the Qumran Report on iTunes, Facebook, skidrow.la, and dramastage-qumran. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family.
All right. That's a wrap.
I didn't get a chance.
And that's the...